Like, because some anxiety should be there.
Yeah, I think so too.
I'll get women, particularly women, not always, sometimes men, who'll come in to me and say, I have a lot of anxiety and around my relationship. And then when I start questioning them about their relationship, I'm thinking, you should have a lot of anxiety. Because like I've had women who are like legitimately abused by their husbands and they come and they want me to make the anxiety go away. And I'm like, I can't do that. Like that would be unethical for me to do. But what I can do is give you the confidence to get out and find safety. And it happens with men too. There are abused men out there.
Of course, you know, they don't get
the attention that from the media and stuff that women get. But sometimes men can be just even abused psychologically, and that's very debilitating. So that's an example of an anxiety you should have. Or if you are entering into a dangerous neighborhood, you don't want to be calm and relaxed and, you know, non-vigilant in that. You don't. Yeah.
Welcome back to the Too Old for This Shit podcast. I'm your host, Angie Sorensen. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today is the first episode of 2025, and I am excited to kick off the year by sharing some amazing episodes I recorded during my break in November and December. So today, we're starting with Tiffany, who's back for a third time on the show. I always appreciate the fresh perspective she brings. Tiffany is a transformational hypnotherapist, and as usual, her insights are truly valuable. If you find her advice helpful, I have put together a takeaway guide for you to download. You can find the link in the show notes. You do not need it while you're listening, but it's a great way to have all the key takeaways in one place if you need it for later. So without further ado, oh wait, I almost forgot. Why don't you just take like 2 seconds, and if you haven't yet, just give a quick rate, like a 5-star rating and a review for the podcast. Or you can follow, if you're on Spotify, you have to follow. If you're on Apple, you can rate and review, and different platforms have different protocols for this. But if you can show your love, that would be super, super helpful to get this in front of more ears. So you know I can't do this without you. So I really, really appreciate your help. Thank you so much. Have an amazing, amazing start of the year, an amazing 2025 full of health, joy, success, all of your wishes. Be blessed, everything like that. And all the right energy is over to you. So without further ado, please help me give a big, warm welcome to Tiffany. Let's begin. Welcome back, Tiffany. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hello, Angie. It's absolutely my pleasure. It's been a while, but I'm really excited to be here.
I'm really excited to have you back because I always remember you as such a wise person. You've got a very, very wise soul, or like an old soul, if you know. Like, I feel like you've been here many, many times.
Yeah, well, I mean, I am getting kind of old.
Well, you and me both. No, but you look terrific, and you have an incredible mind, and the way you look at life is something that I just always love listening to you. So I'm really excited to have you back on the podcast. You first came on to talk about your experience of being in a religious cult for 15 years and escaping from it. And that was episode 44 called Breaking Free from a Cult. And then I ask you back to go over how the past doesn't define us, it seasons us. And the power of our thoughts and the illusion of control that we have. And that was episode 46 called My Past Has Nothing to Do with You. And I am very, very lucky to count you as one of my guests because, like many of them, you are unsung. Let me try this again. I am very lucky to count you as one of my guests because, like many of them, you are an unsung philosopher. Granted, I made the executive decision to nominate you along them, but I stand by it. And so today, once again, I have asked you back, and we will talk about the nervous system, how we can regulate it, the impact it has on our stress, anxiety, and I feel like it is prevalent everywhere I look. And I have also wanted to learn more about how I can better regulate my nervous system, other than what I'm already doing with my nutrition choices, what I've cut off, and so on. And this may or may not come up in our conversation, but this is just something I wanted to learn how to do, how to improve how I regulate my nervous system. And so before we dive in, Tiffany, please introduce yourself, where you live, and what you do.
So I'm Tiffany Capello, and I am a certified hypnotherapist. I specialize in transformational hypnosis and NLP and life coaching. And my specialty is helping people overcome anxiety, panic attacks in particular. I've developed a trademarked protocol that helps 90% of my clients stop having a panic attack in just 1 hour. And I love what I do, because I had a panic disorder myself. And so right now I have a private practice in Chesterland, Ohio. I love it here. It's a beautiful small town in the US, but I also work on Zoom. And so I get the privilege of just helping people all over the world to first overcome panic attacks, and then second, to deal with that underlying anxiety that dysregulated the nervous system and brought them to a state of panic to begin with. Because if you're having panic attacks, your nervous system is highly dysregulated. And then so many people have a range of dysregulation along a continuum, with a panic attack being more extreme. But a lot of us deal with that. So it's just become very important to me to just speak out about that, because we all deserve to have peace of mind.
Yes. Oh my God. Peace inside and peace of mind is huge.
It's what we all want, isn't it? Everything we do on a day-to-day basis, from the relationships we choose to why we go to work every day to the neighborhood we live in. I mean, sometimes, you know, those choices are limited, but ultimately what we're striving for is peace of mind.
You just make me think of some, like, another question for you, actually.
No problem.
I'll just write it down and I'll ask you that one later. So actually, let's just get some of those definitions out of the way. Would you be able to, first of all, explain the difference between anxiety and panic attacks?
Okay. So a panic attack is when your subconscious mind has decided you are so unsafe that it's giving you massive doses of stress hormones, particularly cortisol, epinephrine, things like that. I won't pretend to be an endocrinologist and have the biochemistry down pat. But what you need to know is that when you have anxiety, your nervous system is dysregulated. When you have panic attacks, your nervous system is dysregulated to the point that it cannot even maintain homeostatic balance within the nervous system. So at that point that you actually go into that full-blown panic attack, you're so dysregulated that your biochemistry within your body is so off that the system basically, in a way, crashes. And that's why when you have panic, you begin to feel like you're going crazy. Mm-hmm. Your body's in chaos. It's actually a physically excruciating experience, and it's a mentally excruciating experience. And very few people, if I ask them, you know, they've never had a panic attack, sometimes they'll say, well, you know, I don't know if I've had a panic attack. But if you've actually had one, there's zero doubt in your mind. Mm-hmm. It's such an extreme experience. And it's honestly one of the most painful, debilitating, worst experiences that anyone could have. Now, before I talk more about anxiety, I will say this. Panic attacks in and of themselves are a trauma. And most people don't realize that. So when you have that first panic attack, that is a hugely traumatic experience for you mentally and physically. And so now your subconscious mind says, oh gosh, what just happened? Even though it was involved, it's a very primitive system. And so this is why once we've had that first panic attack, we often begin to say, okay, I was driving when I had that panic attack. Now I'm afraid to drive. Or I was in a social situation. Now I'm afraid to go into another social situation or to put myself anywhere near anything that was around me when I had that full-blown panic. And so you begin to react with almost a little bit of PTSD towards that previous experience, as opposed to just anxiety, which, you know, when you have anxiety, depending on the severity of it, your nervous system is also dysregulated. But, you know, some anxiety is normal. Okay, how do you know when your anxiety is normal? And when your anxiety has reached that pathological point, well, is that anxiety disrupting your life? Is it affecting your relationships, your job, your ability to parent your children? Is it stopping you from doing your fulfilling your visions and dreams and reaching goals? Because, you know, normal anxiety looks like this. You're going into an unfamiliar situation and you're nervous about it. Pathological anxiety is I can't sleep, I can't eat, I'm getting physical symptoms of anxiety, I'm having looping, frightening thoughts about this upcoming event or something happened in the past or future. So there's clearly a difference. And then when that keeps escalating, that's when the dysregulation gets so high that panic occurs.
Isn't there also something called anxiety attack? And how would you know if it's an anxiety attack or a panic attack?
Yeah, and a lot of people get that confused. Anxiety attack is basically not really a real technical term. So that's sort of defined by the individual experience in it. But a full-blown panic attack is when the system has become so dysregulated that it's in complete chaos. An anxiety attack is the buildup prior to a full-blown panic attack. So it's, you know, your heart's racing a little bit, you know, you're feeling nervous and jittery. So a lot of people get those confused. So I always just sort of talk through the person, because if I'm working with someone to eradicate their anxiety, the first thing I check for is if they're having panic attacks, because if they are, we have to deal with those first. We have to stop those panic attacks, which is actually surprisingly very easy. Well, I should say it's simple. It's not necessarily easy, but once you know how to do it, overcoming panic is not that difficult. And the reason why panic should be dealt with first, before you deal with your thinking patterns and all this that's causing the anxiety, is because of the fact that each individual panic attack is like layering trauma upon trauma every time it happens.
I mean, it makes me more and more nervous. I know that when I have had panic attacks, this was like years ago, and it happened. I'm not sure if I had it in the lockdown. I think it was more anxiety at that point. But when I had full blown panic attacks, like, you know, like we spoke, you know, offline, you and I, that there was one of them, it was like having a heart attack. It felt like I had a heart attack, and I called the doctor, and he said go to the A&E. But the A&E, they thought they did all the tests, but they said, "Oh, are you anxious?" And then I felt like such the biggest idiot. I felt like but it felt like my heart was coming out of my chest. And I remember a friend of mine at school. I didn't have that when I well, I didn't have that particular thing. But I had my friend at school. She had quite a lot of that. And I remember one time she told me that she used these exact same words. She said, I felt like my heart was coming out of my chest. It was so painful. And for the first time, like 15 years later, I was like, that's what she meant. And it feels very, very real. It feels very, very real. And that one came on when I had no negative thoughts. I didn't have anxious thoughts. I thought I was fine. I thought I was doing better. And my body was telling me otherwise. So, yeah, I mean, they feel very real.
And that was my experience too. And people don't realize that you know, everyone kind of knows that if you're thinking negative thoughts, that's going to be a creator of anxiety in your life. You know, if you're going into a job interview and you're thinking, oh, they're not going to hire me. I'm not cut out for this. I'm too stupid, or I don't look attractive. And if you're thinking that way, you're not going to be real confident during that interview. But then there's there's that cognitive top-down anxiety that we produce with our thinking.
Yeah,
that thinking is often not our fault. It's easy to take the blame for that. But, you know, our thinking is programmed in by our experiences, our childhood, traumas, culture, religion. There's so many factors. The media is a huge one nowadays.
Yes.
But then there's that anxiety that we feel viscerally in our body, and it takes us completely by surprise. Now, mind you, something's going on in the subconscious, but it's below your level of awareness. Now, I'm going to give you an example of this from a former client I had. So I had a client come to me. She was 68 years old, and she had never had a panic attack in her life until she's 68. She's in the grocery store at, I think, you know, one of the local grocery stores, purchasing food in the checkout line, and has a full-blown panic attack. Now, how many times in 68 years had this woman shopped? And she wasn't cognitively aware that that she was nervous. Like, she didn't go to the store and think, oh, I'm so afraid to go through the checkout and buy my food. There was no negative thinking. She had a full-blown panic attack in the checkout line. Now, subconsciously, something very profound was going on for this woman that was below her level of awareness. And this is important for people with panic to understand. In her past, many, many years earlier, she had been raped by a man wearing a certain type of cologne. The gentleman standing behind her was also an older gentleman. He was wearing that same cologne. Now, of course, consciously,
of course, that would trigger anyone. That would trigger anyone.
Now, but she doesn't notice that. She doesn't say to herself, oh, the cologne that the man has on behind me is that same cologne. There's no conscious process there. But her subconscious mind, you know, our minds are there to protect us, okay? They're not trying to, if you're having panic anxiety, your mind is not broken. It's not trying to make your life miserable. Your mind is 100% invested with protecting you. The scent of that cologne triggered an immediate reaction outside of her conscious awareness. Oh my gosh, I'm now in this dangerous situation where I was attacked once again. The panic attack was there to get her to run. Which is what you know, if you've had a panic attack, you know, the thing you feel doing is running and getting away from the people. Danger you're in. Yeah. And the thing is, you can't get away from what's going on inside your own body. Mm-hmm. You can't get away from that. And so she fled the store, and then we were able to get to the bottom of what the trigger was. But luckily, you don't even actually have to know the trigger to recover from panic. So she was lucky to discover that.
I mean, it's interesting that in the moment she didn't connect those two things, but later on she could recall that there was the cologne that.
Well, I do hypnosis. I do hypnosis, like I said. That's where we access the subconscious mind, and we were able to figure that out. But she had stopped having panic by the time we actually discovered that, because you don't need to know the reason you're panicking to overcome panic. Otherwise, because some people don't know. Like when I had a severe panic disorder. So it was so severe that, like you mentioned, you know, going to ER. Well, let's just say I showed up so many times at ER that when I would walk in the door, the medical staff would roll their eyes.
Oh, that's the worst. That's the worst.
Oh, talk about feeling so bad. It took about 10 visits and an echocardiogram for them to convince me. I was like 34 when this was happening. I'm now 55. That I wasn't having a heart attack, there's nothing wrong with my heart, and that I was actually having panic, because the visceral feeling is so painful. It's like to try to tell you that your mind has created this complete physiological chaos is so hard to grasp. And so I was sure I was having a heart attack. I had all the symptoms, and that's what makes it difficult for people entering into the realm of a panic disorder. When you first hit that experience, all you know is you've got all the symptoms of a heart attack. So very few people on that first panic attack go, oh, I know I'm not having a heart attack. Even 16-year-olds think, oh my God, I'm having a heart attack. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, so my friend was 15 when she told me, and when I had it in, I was over 30. I was probably like 30, 31. Yeah. I think I can't remember the exact age, but, it was so painful. I'd never, you know, and at the time I used to, you know, I knew how to run. I had good cardio and, mm-hmm. So it's not because I was out of breath lying down in my bed, but it felt like it was really painful. You just said something. You said you don't need to know the reason why you're panicking to stop the panic attacks. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, sometimes we can find the subconscious reason for the panic, and sometimes we don't find it. But I'm talking about in what I do with transformational hypnosis. Sometimes I don't actually discover the cause, and that's okay. You just need to understand the physiology and of panic and how to shut that down, which is what I do. That's my specialty. I see probably more people with panic disorder than any other type of client. I do a 1-hour coaching session with them and I teach them how not to go into a panic attack, because in order to panic, you have to do something innocently. You know, it would be too much for this podcast for me to go into teaching everyone how to beat that, because mm-hmm. it does require some one-on-one attention, just because everyone's experiences are nuanced and different. However, but people do get worried. What if I don't know why I'm panicking? For example, my first panic attack occurred in the middle of the night from a dead sleep. Talk about scary, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't understand what was facilitating it. And looking back, like I know, because I became so bad that I became agoraphobic. Like I didn't leave my house. I didn't want to leave my house because everything triggered me into panic. I went from not having a panic disorder, and I had anxiety, I'll be honest, but I had a full-blown panic disorder come on in a single day. And unlike some people, like, well, I seem to have a panic attack once a month, or I had panic attacks multiple times a day.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I went from 0 to 100. I guess I'm an overachiever. So, and, you know, and it was so awful. And I have some ideas in my mind now about, okay, this, you know, I wasn't getting the sleep I needed, da, 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 da. So there were this, and I had a traumatic childhood, very traumatic, in my early years, before my dad got custody of me. So it's understandable how maybe my nervous system was set up for, being highly sensitive. I was already dysregulated just by my day-to-day existence, you know. But I never really discovered every nuance of what was triggering me. That wasn't necessary to recover. So that's a good news.
Yeah, that's good to know, because also sometimes it can be, you don't need to also re-traumatize your body, right? It's like I heard someone explain, there's a person, this was on YouTube, and she does a lot around personal development and so on. And she had some highly traumatic experiences as a child, but some of it she sort of remembered, some of it she didn't, and she kept seeing everywhere that she had to, you know, find, you know, get to the root of it, almost, you know, uncover all the nitty-gritty about it. And she spoke about it to her therapist. She says, you know that she doesn't remember some parts, and you know, she probably she thought that she had to go and revisit everything. And her therapist said, you're a highly functioning individual who has, you know, she'd gone through quite a big change in her life and worked a lot on herself. But she now is in a second marriage that's healthy. She's got, you know, healthy children. She's making a very good living. You know, a lot of the things are going really well. She says, why are you wanting to re-traumatize your body and your mind, if actually
that was a good therapist.
Yeah, exactly. Because other people would be like, ka-ching, another 50 sessions for me right here, you know? So, and she was like, yeah, why do I want to do that? No, I don't need to. Yeah, you're right. Obviously, I think certain things, you know, unless it comes up for her maybe later where she, there's something comes up and she needs to address it, maybe then yes. But I think, you know, some things your maybe your body or your mind has processed more than you realize, and you know, you just needed to do that extra push. But yeah, I think, yeah, there's no, like, so not needing to know why, I think, yeah, there's no need to go into.
Well, and here's the thing, and you brought up a really good point, because things are shifting in the psychotherapy world and the therapy world generally, but back when I was in my early 30s, that was the mindset that, okay, Tiffany had a traumatic childhood, so therefore we have to go process all of the trauma one by one. And I remember thinking to myself, because I saw 5 different therapists, only one of them was any good. Yes. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm going to be 90 before I process all of this. In the first 6 years of my life, there was so much of it because my mom was a drug addict. Okay. And it wasn't a safe situation. But it's, you know, there is some of what I do is getting to the root of what's causing the anxiety. However, it's not necessary that you process all these individual traumas, because for so many people, that's a lot. But these traumas have an underlying theme or belief. Okay. Like, let's say an individual is struggling with, they're just not moving forward in their career. They're having a lot of anxiety because they believe on some subconscious level that they're stupid, because maybe their dad told them they were stupid, and maybe kids made fun of them for being stupid. Maybe they, you know, struggled to learn to read those first couple of years or whatever. And then maybe they got in an abusive relationship where the partner said, you know, you're just so stupid. Okay. So you can see how a person under those circumstances is going to develop the belief that I'm stupid. So it's not all those individual traumas. Like, you don't have to reprogram and process all the times you were bullied in school and all the times your dad said you were stupid and all of the negative criticism of your ex-spouse. It's the belief that I'm stupid that has to shift. And that's all that needs to shift. So that simplifies things, I think, in people's minds when it comes to how do I straighten out the mess created by all of this crap that happened to me in the past. So when I go to help people work through what happened in the past to recover from the anxiety, it's the belief, not the individual traumas. Doesn't mean we don't talk about or look at things at all. I mean, we might talk about how did you get to have this strong belief in yourself, you know, we might discover some of that. And it's useful because it helps the client to have some self-awareness and insight. But if we just find out why we're struggling, it doesn't do us a whole hell of a lot of good. We need to reframe all that, but it's the belief we're reframing, not all the individual traumas.
I just got a question around this. Like, you know, certain things, you know, we may know that we struggle with, and we know why we struggle with it. And I mean, for me personally, for example, in terms of sleeping, you know, I used to have insomnia quite a bit, especially in my 20s. I was never a good sleeper as well as a teenager and a bit younger. But as an adult, I mean, I'm much better now. I've got a really good routine. But what has stayed with me is, like, if I sleep somewhere new, I'm not going to sleep that first night, or very, very little. And if I'm sharing my space, I can feel the energy there's someone else. Or like, even if it's a cat, and I love cats, I just feel there's an energy that I find it very difficult to relax and fall asleep. But the thing is, for me, it's not something that I necessarily want to get rid of, because I think that's a very good survival instinct. But it can be quite disruptive if I need to, not that I travel a lot so much now, but you know, but I think some of the things sometimes, I guess my question is, how do we know if that quirk that we have is healthy to keep, or if it's our thinking around it that is actually not healthy anymore and actually we should just maybe fix it?
That's a really good question. I think it depends on whether it's disrupting your life. Because some anxiety should be there.
Yeah, I think so too.
I'll get women, particularly women, not always, sometimes men, who'll come in to me and say, I have a lot of anxiety and around my relationship. And then when I start questioning them about their relationship, I'm thinking, you should have a lot of anxiety. Because like I've had women who are like legitimately abused by their husbands and they come and they want me to make the anxiety go away. And I'm like, I can't do that. Like that would be unethical for me to do. But what I can do is give you the confidence to get out and find safety. And it happens with men too. There are abused men out there.
Of course, you know, they don't get
the attention that from the media and stuff that women get. But sometimes men can be just even abused psychologically. And that's very debilitating. So that's an example of an anxiety you should have. Or if you are entering into a dangerous neighborhood, you don't want to be calm and relaxed and, you know, non-vigilant in that. You don't.
Exactly.
Now, regarding what you said specifically, you know, if you like when I go into a hotel room, I make sure I'm in a safe hotel room. You know, they have that little latch on the door, you know?
Yeah, but I'm like, I never feel like it's enough. I'm like, yeah.
And you could even buy these little door alarms so that if you put it on the door alarm, if somebody tries to open that door, it's going to go off. So the thing is, like, it's probably, if you don't mind not sleeping the first night, but if you have some speech you have to give the next day, that might not be very useful to you. Yeah. And there's strategies for teaching your subconscious mind that you are safe in that situation so you can sleep. You know, we could even go into that if you're open to doing that. You know, like I'll give an example from because when our nervous systems are dysregulated, we will get these. And when you're lying there trying not to sleep, you probably don't feel real relaxed. I'm going to take a guess.
Yeah.
There's a tension within your system. There's a hypervigilance. Your sympathetic nervous system is revving up because your mind believes that in this unfamiliar situation, Angie's not safe. Mm-hmm. So I better keep her awake all night. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Until I've checked out this place and it feels safe to me. Okay. Mm-hmm. So your brain is trying to protect you. And that's super important that we are thankful for that. But if you want to sleep better under these circumstances, because perhaps the reason you're out of town is because you have something to do with work and you need to be sharp the next day and going a whole night without sleep is not going to help you along those lines. You can retrain your subconscious brain to learn that this situation is safe for me. And sometimes, you know, it is super useful. And people think this is kind of corny and they feel weird doing it at first, but something I do all the time because you can talk to your brain. I'm going to give an example of this from my own life. Because my childhood was so traumatic, those first 5-6 years, the younger you are when you are in danger and have trauma, the more your nervous system gets dysregulated. We talked a lot about the top down, the thinking that produces anxiety in the body. But when you are that itty bitty child, like your 6-month-old child, and like for me, I was in a violent situation. My mom was a drug addict and my mom was a Hell's Angel. Okay. She was a biker gang. Yeah. So, so there was a lot of violence around me and, you know, so my nerve, you know, my brain, even brain of a tiny child goes, this is not a safe place. This person needs to be upregulated and you will develop a nervous system that's very vigilant and will react at the drop of a hat because your brain is determined. Well, this is a mechanism of survival. This is how we've survived as a species because we can adapt. You know, if you've had a beautiful childhood, you can still develop anxiety. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can, there's plenty of things that can happen in life that can create that for you. But when you've had that early trauma, it sort of locks itself into your nervous system. And that's when people get these strange, in their mind, visceral responses to what appears to be benign stimuli in your external environment. Okay. Mm-hmm. And there's no negative thought associated because as that 6-month-old child, I wasn't thinking. You know, my brain hadn't developed to the point where I'm going, oh, wow, this is a dangerous situation. And I'm having, you know, cognitive processes about that. So that anxiety develops within the nervous system and it sort of stays there. And so it creates a much higher level of dysregulation than someone who, say, had a really good childhood and then at 8 gets in a car accident and their mom passes. That's very traumatic.
Yeah.
But it's a different type of trauma because there's a cognitive way to process that that isn't there at 6 months old, at 1, at a year and a half, at 2. The younger you are when you have the trauma, the more likely it's going to be sort of locked in viscerally for you.
But I think, like, for me, that those reactions has what has kept me safe. Does that make sense? So actually, I've always been sort of very blessed in that way. So that's also mm-hmm. why I feel like that's actually my guardian, you know, because actually having that alertness and that slight panic or anxiety around it is what has kept me safe and super alert. And, you know,
yeah. And there is something to be said for
getting out of bad situations, basically. It's helped me get out of it. Yeah. So, yeah.
So hypervigilance in a way, that's good you brought that up because it can be a blessing. I mean, like if you're hypervigilant, you're probably going to make a better CEO of a company. Okay. Because you will do what a good CEO does and you're going to think about what could possibly go wrong and plan for that. And hopefully you don't have anxiety and you could actually do it from a proactive, empowered, confident standpoint. Okay, instead of, oh my God, I can't sleep at night because of all the bad things that can happen. There's a different way to experience hypervigilance. Like, I'm hypervigilant still, but I'm also very happy. I do not have chronic anxiety and I have peace of mind, not 100%. Nobody has 100% peace of mind. Nobody never experiences anxiety. We're all human, but, you know, I also am still working on my nervous system because of what I experienced in those first 5-6 years of my life. I was getting those visceral reactions in the body without the negative thinking. Okay, this is where people get really confused. They're like, how could this be anxiety if I'm not thinking negative? And they spend months searching for a physiological cause because they believe something's physically wrong with them. They have a disease or disorder. The doctor keeps telling them they're having panic and they don't believe it. That was me. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm not having a negative thought. And in my mind, you had to have that negative thought. And that was more of the thinking back then. We have learned more about the subconscious mind, about the nervous system. And so like one of the issues I had that would really illustrate this, and I'm still actually working on, I'll be honest, is I developed at the age of 3, a tic disorder, not Tourette's syndrome. This was a stress-related nervous system tic disorder. To this day, I still have it. It's improved and is improving through the nervous system, the somatic type work that I'm doing with myself, the same stuff I do with my clients. Because you can, when your body is reacting, it's important that we don't discount that. When your body is viscerally reacting with a stress response, an anxiety response, what we often do is we just go, oh, I don't have time for this. And we sort of push it aside. But all of these uncomfortable emotions and sensations are loving messengers from your brain to you that says, hey, I'm not feeling safe. Okay. And so you can address that. Like if you had a child that came to you and said, you know, you're babysitting, you got your own child, doesn't matter, and says, I am so scared. I think there's a monster under my bed. You're not going to go. I hope you won't go. Well, that's stupid. Go to bed. Okay. You know, that's dumb. Go to bed. Yeah. Leave me alone. Okay. That would not be the greatest, most compassionate, loving response that you could give. This child is afraid and needs reassurance. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. You would go, you'd hold the child's hand, you'd go in the room, you'd flip on the light and you know, you might remove the stuff under the bed and you'd go, look, there's no monster. And then hopefully the kid will go, oh, okay. You might lay down with the kid for a little bit. Okay. Yeah. You need to prove to the child there's no monster. You need to prove to your subconscious mind there's no monster. How do you do that? So I'll use my own experience with my nervous tic to illustrate the process of doing that for those who are interested. So I developed this nervous tic as a three-year-old child, and it would come out at certain times. There were years when it disappeared entirely, and there were years when it was pretty bad. And it was pretty subconscious, so I wouldn't necessarily know that I was ticking. Okay. Like, as I got older, it started to look weird because I'm no longer a kid, right? But some of the times when I would tick were while driving, which is strange. I've never really been in a serious accident. I have no negative thought process about driving. I actually love to drive here in Ohio in the fall when the leaves are all changing. It's so beautiful. And I'm like, oh, I love this. It's so beautiful. The sun's shining. So I'm not going, oh my God, what if I get in an accident? What if someone pulls it? None of these negative thoughts, but my body is viscerally ticking in a stressed way. I could feel nervous tension building. And so that's a message viscerally saying, I don't feel safe here in the car. Okay. And it doesn't make sense to me on a conscious level because I actually enjoy driving and I don't consider it to be, you know, terribly dangerous. Everything's dangerous, you know, of course, at some point. Now, so I can't say, this is dumb. Okay. Stop ticking. It's not going to work. Okay. This is a process occurring in my body. Now, I would guess that came from the fact that my mom was a drug addict. And I do remember hitting the windshield a couple times as a kid. Drunk driving was something that she did often, and she continued to do her entire life and got in multiple accidents, lost her license for 11 years, okay?
Yeah.
You know, until she passed. But so perhaps that's where it came from. I don't know. Maybe I'll never know. Okay, it doesn't matter. But I'll tell you how I have been retraining my brain to not be afraid in the situation. I speak to my brain. Now, I speak to my brain like a loving parent would to a child. Okay, this is important because if you're pissed off at your brain, oh my God, this tick again or this tension again. Oh God, this is so stupid. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is a personal attack that you're directing at yourself. And it's just like a personal attack that anyone externally, like a friend or a relative or a partner, you know, you don't feel comfortable around that. Okay. This is not useful. It's going to agitate your nervous system even further. Okay. Your goal when your body's sending you the message, hey, I don't feel safe, is to help your mind and body to feel safe. Beating yourself up and criticizing yourself is going to have the opposite effect. So your brain is trying to keep you safe. So it's almost good to look at it and say, oh, okay, I see that you don't feel safe right now, just like you would a child. Okay. And like, here I am driving down the road. Suddenly I start ticking or I feel some tension maybe in my low back. And I say, okay, I look around. This is where I use something called five senses immersion. Okay. This is not a word I came up with. This is something that I heard from Dr. Howard Schubiner here in the States. He is a pain reprocessing therapy doctor. I've taken a course with him. So I learned about, this is the term they use. I have used it in my own practice before getting that term. However, that's the official term for it. So this is when you use your senses, your five senses, whatever's applicable in this, to teach your subconscious you're safe. So here I am driving, I'm starting to tick, and I begin to focus on what I'm seeing, my visual sense, okay? And I'm looking around and I go, look, everything's safe. Now, here's an important word that you want to say when you're using your senses to teach your brain you're safe. I'm safe right now, okay? Because your brain might go, yeah, but that car up there, now I don't have negative thoughts necessarily, but that could, car could cross the line and then you wouldn't be safe. So I say I'm safe right now. And I tell my brain, if I get into a dangerous situation, you are welcome to alarm the shit out of me. Now, that would be useful, right? Yeah. It would be useful if you're lying there in a bed in a hotel room and you say to your brain, you look around and say, see, you know, you look in the closet, you look under the bed, there's no one here, there's no danger. I'm safe right now, but you're welcome. You should alarm me, and I welcome a stress response if there's actually a danger, because I know that's so useful. And it would be useful, but you don't need to have the stress response when you're safe if it's affecting you physiologically, keeping you from sleeping. So I'm safe right now, okay? And then I might listen, because our visual sense and our auditory sense are two of the main ways that our brain learns we're either safe or in danger. So if your brain learned erroneously based on past experiences, still reacting to, we can retrain that. So then I will listen and I'll say, okay, there's no screeching tires coming towards me. There's nothing, you know, I might have some soft music playing in the background. Like, listen, there's no danger coming at me. I'm safe. Okay. Now, you have other senses, like the sense of smell. You could say, no, nothing burning, my car's running great, you know. Probably the sense of taste is not going to be appropriate while I'm driving unless I'm eating something. You know, I wouldn't be eating this chip if I was in any danger. You know, I'm eating, that proves that I'm safe. Okay, so this, you know, the conversation can occur out loud, it can occur in your head. Sometimes I'll just rub my leg or my arm a little bit if I can, and just like I would a child, and go, I'm perfectly safe. Okay. Now it's important to understand this is a process. You won't instantly, okay, nervous tick gone. Okay. It's a process. My brain learned somewhere back there that driving was really dangerous, even though I've never had it as an adult, a bad accident. I'm teaching my mind I'm safe. Okay. I'm talking to my mind, and I will say some key phrases, and people might want to write down these key phrases. It might be helpful if they can grab a pen. But the key phrases are, I am safe. And I add the word now. Okay. I'm safe right now. I'm not in any danger right now. Everything is okay right now. You know, those three phrases I will repeat. I will say out loud why I'm safe. I'm safe right now, you know, and I will even say things like, look at how much space I left between this car and the car in front of me. There's so much space. I could stop in plenty of time. You know, not that I had a direct negative thought about that. I'm just thinking about what my fearful brain might be thinking about, and I'm reassuring it along those lines. I'm a really good driver. You know, I'm not looking at my cell phone. I'm paying attention. Now, oddly, I had noticed that my ticking was worse if I wasn't leaving that space between the car in front of me and myself, because I had this notorious bad habit, my fiance will tell you, of riding people's asses when I was driving. It was not a conscious thing. I was trying to do it. I didn't get too close, and he could, you back it off a little bit. And I actually noticed that my body was sending me a signal that this doesn't feel safe. You're too damn close to the car in front of you. Now, the more, I will add this in, the more you repress uncomfortable emotions, the more your body will be forced to express those viscerally.
Yeah.
If you believe that negative emotions are dangerous or bad, or they make you weak or somehow, you know, an inadequate person, your body will begin to express that viscerally. And sometimes that will come out in the form of physical symptoms that are pretty bizarre, like chronic back pain. You go to the doctor.
Go ahead. What you say about the back pain? I have, I'm sure I've heard this more than once, but I can only say one time because I can only recall one person who's told me this. But this person, she was in a long-term relationship, and she had back pain almost throughout the whole thing. And the minute that relationship was over, the back pain was gone.
Yeah, this is super common.
Certain parts of your body and the symptoms there are related to certain areas of your life. you know, like the book by, and now I'm blanking on her name, Louise Hayes, where you can look up, let's say, if you have like back pain, or if you keep getting colds or bronchitis and so on and so forth, it can tell you the areas of your life that are, that you need to look at. And there's like a little sentence you can say to yourself. And when I've looked them up, for me, they're always really, I find they're quite accurate.
I've seen some, I have a few of those books, and for me, they haven't been that accurate, but who knows, maybe I'm not as self-aware as I should be. But I have found that if you do not allow if you're an emotional represser, someone who is constantly either, you know, I'm too busy, I've got a lot to do, I can't afford to deal with this emotion, or I'm going to numb my emotion by drinking, watching Netflix, porn, whatever, and you're not experiencing your emotions, you will be prone to what's called TMS. I believe the term is tension myositis syndrome. If people want more information on that, I suggest they read Dr. John Sarno. He was a U.S. orthopedic surgeon. He wrote The Mind-Body Prescription. He wrote these sorts of books. And so it explains
TMS is TMS a pain or what is?
It's a legitimate pain, okay. But the TMS is an umbrella term for broad variety of symptoms produced by the brain and the body. Now, I want to be very clear here: the symptoms themselves are real. So I'm not saying, okay, if you have chronic back pain, you made it up because you were unhappy in your relationship. The pain is very real, okay, because all pain in the body is generated from the brain, okay? So this is why amputees who maybe you have diabetes, yeah. And you have to have your leg amputated below the knee, and they get what's called phantom limb pain. Yes, and they go to the doctor and say, okay, this is weird, doc, but my foot hurts, but I have no foot. Now, all your brain knows is that something is wrong with my foot. This is your limbic brain is a primitive brain. It doesn't, you can't figure out and reason that, oh, well, the foot was amputated because I had diabetes. Okay, your brain is reacting to the absence of the foot by sending a danger signal that something's wrong down there. And it's sending pain as that signal that something is wrong. If you sprain your ankle, the pain is there as a loving messenger to keep you from walking on the ankle. So your brain will send uncomfortable emotions to you to teach you one of three things. And I don't know if we covered this when I spoke with you last on the podcast, so I'm going to cover it now. The first thing your brain will send you an uncomfortable emotion for is something in your past needs to heal. Okay. Number two, something in your present life needs to change. Perfect example, that was your friend in a toxic relationship. Number three, you have a toxic belief. Just like if you eat toxic food and it makes your stomach upset, toxic beliefs make your spiritual and emotional self upset. Now, so the brain will send you these uncomfortable emotions. If you repress them, push them away, stuff them down, then your brain may send chronic physical symptoms. It's not just pain, okay? It can also be dizziness. Dizziness is a huge one. Brain fog, pins and needles. I've had so many of them in my life until I learned this truth and started dealing with my physical symptoms as these loving messengers. Chronic headaches. A lot of what's diagnosed as fibromyalgia. Chronic fatigue. Some long-haul COVID. Quite honestly, has been discovered to be TMS. And now when I say this, because I had chronic fatigue syndrome, actual diagnosed, I've had cluster headaches and all this stuff. I'm not saying there's no physical problem, okay, or that you made up your fatigue or pain. All of these symptoms are 100% genuine, debilitating, and real. They're caused by the dysregulation in the nervous system from, the symptoms being sent as a danger signal. Your subconscious mind believes you're in danger. Mm-hmm. And it's And that's why it's sending the signal.
Yeah, I mean, so sometimes it will be the nervous system, but obviously sometimes you can get pins and needles because you have a trapped nerve, right? So that would be, there'll also be a physical cause, right? Obviously, that we're just obviously
so that's why it's important.
We're obviously just focusing on the nervous system angle here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And even if you think, okay, that makes sense, my symptoms are caused by nervous system dysregulation, you still need to go to your doctor. Like, even if you say, oh, I'm having a panic attack, you still need to go to your doctor and make sure you're not having a heart attack. You need that medical workup. And if, you know, if you have all sorts of strange symptoms, you don't want to say, well, okay, it's got to, you know, I had a bad childhood, so this has got to be, you know, what Tiffany's talking about in that podcast with Angie. You can't assume that. You have to go to your medical doctor and you have to rule out a physiological cause. And when the doctor says, we can't find anything wrong with you, that's when you start to say, okay, could it be I'm under so much stress or I've had so much trauma, you know, that this is what's going on within my system. And I'm working with a lot of these people now. I'm running into, and I primarily work with anxiety, and I found that a large percentage of my anxiety clients also deal with chronic pain and symptoms, and the doctor can't find out what's wrong with them.
Yeah, I mean, often also, you know, like stress will make your muscle really tense, right? And then you'll have your upper back and your neck tense, and that will give you a stress headache, you know. And they're not nice, obviously, to have. So, there's also a way there where the nervous system regulates, or your brain does something that makes you feel sleepy. Like it's a form of procrastination, like a stress procrastination. So you'll feel sleepy. I don't know if you ever heard of this.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And it's often like when you try to, I mean, it can also happen when you try to up level your life, right? So you have to do new things that will feel unfamiliar. That's going to seem like they're hard. And then instead of like, actually, you know, you're about to sit down at your laptop, for example, to, you know, start doing something. And suddenly you feel, oh gosh, I could really do with a nap. And that's basically your brain tricking you. I had someone point that out to me. I thought it was the funniest thing ever, but I was just like, that is kind of cute that your brain tells you to go to sleep. Like, you know, that, or, you know, that's the reaction. It's obviously not great if you always submit to it, because obviously then you don't get anything done. But it's, it has very funny ways of telling you, of giving you those signals.
A lot of what self-sabotage is, like, okay, you know, and everyone's done this. You're about, you know, you go to sit down and do something that's going to advance your career, or maybe you're going to start a business. And every time you go to take action on these goals, suddenly you feel like organizing your sock drawer, or you get really tired, or you lack motivation, and we get frustrated. We think, what's wrong with my brain? The brain, it's that underlying belief that I talked about earlier. Your brain doesn't believe that for you to go out there and put yourself out there in the world or go after that promotion is safe for you. So it's going to try to get you to not do it. Not because your brain has it out for you, because your brain legit doesn't believe it's safe. Now, why doesn't it believe you're safe? Because there's a subconscious belief in there that maybe I'm inadequate. I'm not smart enough to do this. I'm not capable of doing this. Okay. So that's just a few of those reasons. But when, you know, when we get any physical symptom that goes along with anxiety, people get caught in a cycle where they actually respond to physical symptoms of either they know are anxiety or physical symptoms that are caused by repressing these emotions. And so there's a danger signal being sent. There's six things that you could do in that moment that will make it worse. Okay. It'll make it worse. Okay. And this applies both to panic attacks, because panic attacks have such severe symptoms, and to just that daily, you know, stress headaches thing. These are called the six F's of symptom processing. Okay. And when you do these things, you will reinforce to your subconscious mind that you're in danger, okay? The first of the six is fear, okay? You're afraid of the sensations, okay? Like you're going into a state of panic and you're thinking, oh my God, it's those symptoms again, they're so scary. You're afraid of them And that reinforces to your brain you're in danger instead of sending a message of safety to the brain. Two, you focus on that. Okay, so you develop what's called symptom focusing, where you're just spending all day scanning and monitoring your body for symptoms. That's reinforcing to your subconscious mind. Yes, I'm legitimately in danger. Not only the danger that you thought I was in to bring these symptoms into my life, but these symptoms in and of themselves are dangerous. So I've got to watch out for them. I got to be scared of them. Fighting them is another thing. We usually do that. We give them power by sitting this. We get angry. I hate the symptom. It's okay to be a little angry, but we're fighting them. I'm just not going to feel it. We're fighting ourselves when we do that. The fourth F is being frustrated. You're just walking around all day annoyed because you're having these symptoms. You're annoyed at your brain. You're annoyed at the symptom. Figure it out. You're spending hours on the internet trying to figure out what is wrong with you. What's causing these sensations? What's wrong with me?
So when okay. when you talk about, with these examples, the six, the sensations and the symptoms, what can you just give one symptom or a sensation that you would be referring to, for example?
Okay, this one's super common with people. And it's I will bring this one up because it's probably the most debilitating of all TMS type symptoms or, cortisol related, which is brain fog. It's scary because cognitively you don't feel right. Brain fog was a symptom I had really bad. And it felt like someone came up behind me and shot me up with some weird drug and I couldn't think right. I felt fuzzy. I felt almost drunk. It was super scary. Okay. Until I learned not to be afraid of it. Now, when I'm afraid of that symptom, it would make it worse. Most people with these sorts of stress-related symptoms will go, yeah, the more I'm afraid of my headache or think about it, focus on it, fight it, get frustrated by the worse it gets. I mean, not that there's no legitimate reason for, a medical cause for headache. I'm not saying that, but a lot of headaches are stress. So using my example of brain fog, when I first got the brain fog, I was terrified of it. I thought, oh my God, I'm going crazy. I've got a cognitive problem. My brain is poisoned, all this stuff that went through my head.
Now it makes sense because now I can understand what you mean by like, then you get angry at it, then you get frustrated, then you look online to look for figure it out, the last F, like how do you resolve it? Okay, because I wasn't following just earlier, but now it makes sense. Yeah, I understand.
Well, we're missing one F. So six is try to fix it. That's when you're working really hard to make those sensations go away. Okay, And it's not that it's wrong for you to say, well, maybe if I meditate, I won't have the brain fog because I want to calm my nervous system. If you're meditating because you want to train your brain that you're safe, if you want to meditate to calm your nervous system, these aren't bad things. Okay. When I say fix it, I mean, okay, I'm going to meditate for 20 minutes and you meditate for 20 minutes and then you're all frustrated and angry because it didn't fix it. Okay. Nervous systems take time to heal. One meditation session isn't going to do it. And now you're going through that same fear, focus, fight, frustrated, figure it out, fix it, cycle again. Okay. So back to your question. I just want to make sure I got that last F in there.
Yeah. So how do we make it better then? How, let's say if we were to use a different example, like you said, like you're out there, starting a business and every time you're about to sit down at your computer to start it, you want to clean your sock drawer, you want to clean your house, tidy up, do the laundry, mow the lawn, you're just not doing anything. So it's like almost like a stress response because, you don't feel worthy, you don't think you'll be good enough, you don't think that you should, who are you to think that you can do that? So how do you make it better? So that was like what made it worse, the 6F, but what would make it better?
So the 6Fs are problematic because they reinforce the brain's already established belief that you are in danger. Okay. So what we want to do as an antidote to that is send consistent messages of safety to the brain. Okay. Now, one of the most useful things if you want to recover quickly from something like that is to find out what is the subconscious belief in my mind that I hold that makes my subconscious mind think that this forward action towards achieving my goals is dangerous for me. Well, if you have a subconscious belief that you're stupid and you're going to make a fool of yourself, it's going to be pretty hard to push yourself through that. So addressing that belief is super important. Sometimes you know what those beliefs are and you need to work on those. And sometimes that's what I use hypnosis for, that because it's fast, quick, resolves it. You know, it's not that conscious processes can't work. They just take a lot more time. That's why I've chosen to use hypnosis. But it's not just about that. The method I just mentioned of retraining the brain during physical symptoms, I'm safe now, I'm not in any danger now, using your five senses.
Yeah.
That's a super effective way to send the brain a message of safety. Okay. And then there's some other, there's some other techniques that are super useful. I actually have a document that I will share with you so you could share with your listeners, called Consistent Messages of Safety. Mm-hmm. And this document actually gives you an entire list of things you can do to send a message of safety. Like there's on my YouTube channel, A Transform Life with Tiffany Capello, I have something called Core State Breathing. It's a clinically researched way to calm your nervous system. It will lower your cortisol levels by like 60 to 80%. There's a process called havening that I also have a video on my YouTube channel.
How do you spell that? Havening?
H-A-V-E-N-I-N-G, havening. So I teach it a specific way. I have a video on that on my YouTube channel as well. And there's so many different ways to the first thing I think when there's physical symptoms is the process I described to you about using your senses and consenting those, talking to your brain as if it were a frightened child. You know, that is super useful. It's my favorite go-to, you know, and then in this document that I'll share with you to share with your listeners, you will just see a number of ways of doing that. Acts of self-love, speaking reassuring words, co-regulating with safe people, sometimes just sitting down, like the example that you gave of getting stuck and afraid to move forward, sometimes just sitting down with someone who believes in you.
Nurturing people around you makes a big difference.
Now, it's important to note that a toxic person can have the opposite effect.
Oh, yeah, very.
You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they could make you feel like I might as well just give up because I'm so stupid. I'll never achieve this goal. But when you get with someone who believes in you and you say, I'm struggling here, and that individual says, oh, you're so smart. Look at this example from your life and look at this example. And that is another technique. Think about the past and all the times that you have nailed it. All the times that you've been a badass, all the times that you've overcome great difficulty, all the times that you've learned things that were pretty damn hard. And so why would you assume now you can't? I mean, think about just learning to read. There's 26 letters and they go in like millions of combinations and you learn to do that. And so of course you can learn the skills you need to learn to reach your goals and to get where you need to be. But it's just shifting in that way in your mind that begins to help us out a lot and just help us to get past that. You know, sometimes we need to just drop down out of our own thoughts and just be in the present moment.
You know? I will just add one thing. Sometimes also just it could be movement, right? Sometimes like just going for a run or just going for a walk can really help sometimes to, not saying when you have a full on panic attack, but like just like regular, like regulating nervous system. Right. Like I know for me, I've had to learn to take more breaks during my day, even just small breaks, because it was sometimes I can sit down at my computer and just don't stop, you know, I'll forget to eat and stuff like that. But so it's to actually take more breaks. And I have noticed like it really changes how wound up, you know, that would get so stressed, you know. I wouldn't actually even use the word stress. I would just be quite, you know, I would feel I was quite, there's a word for it, but I can't find it now. But Yeah, it just makes a difference to not feel so tired at the end of the day. But when I take like more breaks, or when I actually do go for a walk or two every day, let's say if I'm working from home, to make sure I go for a walk. And if I do actually have a workout routine, I'm not really in one at the moment. Not like not. I mean, I have just once a week, but normally I'll try. If I do something like 2-3 times a week, I also feel a difference. So sometimes it's also the body that needs to. You almost need to like move it out of your body, if that makes sense. Like it really just helps, like getting some good, good hormones to run through.
Well, and you can see that. In that instance, your brain, those symptoms you're getting, whether they're, sometimes looping thoughts is a symptom. The brain is saying, hey, please fix this, please fix this, please fix this. You know, and it's not that the looping thought might be irrational, but your brain believes I have to consistently bring this up because if Angie doesn't figure it out, she's in danger. You know what I mean? And so sometimes that's a symptom in and of itself. But in the case that you just referred to, your brain is saying, Angie, things are out of balance here. Stop. You know, you're putting too much pressure on me. You're not eating right. You're not sleeping. You're not taking care of yourself. And that's why, self-care is a way to send messages of safety to the brain. If you're pushing yourself, rushing yourself, this was a huge problem for me that I overcame about 6 months ago. Didn't even know I was doing it because I rushed my whole life. Couldn't figure out why I felt agitated and exhausted at the end of the day. And I thought I'm running like a chicken with my head cut off all day long. And when you push and rush and put that kind of pressure on yourself, you're not taking care of yourself. You are agitating your own nervous system. And those symptoms you're getting are your brain saying, hey, this is not good. I don't like this. This is dangerous. This is not healthy. So once again, I think it's super important to remember our brains are never our enemy. It's the messages are always sent in a message. I call them loving messengers, but it's all about protecting you. Yeah. That's why we have to listen. It's so important that we become attuned to our own physiology, because those messages are super important. And when you get those messages that you're in danger, you first need to ask yourself, well, maybe legit I am. Maybe I'm nervous around this dude I've been dating because he's not a safe guy. I had that experience. I had a guy I dated for about 4 months, and I legit, like, my nervous tic was like totally out of control with this guy. And he seemed really nice until he wasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. He went from like the best thing I had ever seen because he was a narcissist and I was in the love bombing stage to I'm going to destroy this woman and take her down as hard as I can, you know, totally abusive. And it was like, I had that aha moment where I went, oh, so your nervous system is your friend.
Yeah, 100%. I agree with that. But I think it's interesting that you mentioned about when thoughts keep coming, it's like you're nervous, or it's like your brain saying, listen to it. It's trying to get your attention. So that's probably like what, I mean, intrusive thoughts can be a little bit different, but like when you have like repetitive thoughts, you know, or you know how they say like you have the same thoughts, I think 90% or even more are the same thoughts. Sorry, you know what? Let me just take a beat. Hang on, that's not what I'm trying to say. I know what I'm trying to say, but my words are not coming out right. Basically, is that there's a really big percentage of the thoughts that you have on a daily basis, every single day. A big portion of them are just the same, that you're just regurgitating day in, day out. And so, you know, whether it could be anything like, oh, hate my job, hate my boss, oh, I love my job, love my, you know, whatever it is, they're actually always the same ones. So it could, yeah, like you said, like if it's something that keeps coming back, it could be your brain telling you, pay attention, pay attention.
It always is that, but this is where we have to be discerning. Some thoughts are there because there's a legit reason, something you need to pay attention to today. And some thoughts are learned patterns and conditioned responses from the past that aren't useful today. Yeah, I think we all have these examples in our life where relationships really bring this out in us. So we're talking with that significant other. And it doesn't even have to be a partner, like a husband or a boyfriend or a girlfriend. It could be a best friend, someone close to us. And then we have this reaction to something they say. And it's like, we just like go from zero to 100 really fast. And then later, like the next day, we look back on that conversation and go, oh my God, what just happened? Like my response was so disproportionate to what this person actually said. And that's when we know we were triggered from something in the past. Something in the past was triggered.
Yeah.
And then that's, and it's interesting because sometimes you won't always know. But if you're having an irrational thought, like, you know, a lot of times we have irrational thoughts, and you're thinking, why would I be worried about that? Like, I had a client recently, and he said, you know, he had been cheated on by his ex-wife. Well, now he's got this great new fiance who lets him know every moment what she's doing because she wants so much to comfort him. And so there's no problem with her. I always ask those questions when I'm talking to someone to make sure there's no problem. But he's having these constant looping thoughts of she's probably with another guy. She's probably cheating. But because his brain is still convinced that the girlfriend is this is my new life experience. Everyone's going to cheat on me. And that's where subconscious work becomes so crucial to get a person out of that loop of, you know, learn you can, this is a conditioned response based on past experience, but you can, whatever, let me just say it this way. Whatever can be programmed into your brain by traumas, negative experiences, shitty things people said to you, doesn't matter. All of that can be programmed out. Okay. That's the good news. You're not stuck with any negative thinking pattern. It can all be programmed out. I use hypnosis for that because it's fast, faster than anything I know of, you know, at this point. So I use it for myself. I use it for my clients. It can be done in person, online, doesn't matter. But, you know, everything can be programmed out that's programmed in. And that includes when there's that visceral response we talked about earlier, where the mind is not thinking a negative thought, but the body is reacting, you can neurally retrain that through the process I explained earlier. You know, that's one of the processes of sending those messages of safety, talking your brain like your little child, looking, hearing, listening, you know, all of that to let your brain know I'm safe. Mm.
So before, this is really great. Thank you so much, Tiffany. Just before I ask you the finishing thoughts, I just want to have just like a quick question. Because you mentioned chickens and I thought, you said something about chicken and I thought, okay, chicken or the egg. Is there like a straight yes, no answer to what comes first, stress or a dysregulated nervous system?
Oh, definitely stress. But that stress can happen as an early young child, like even from the moment of birth and probably even before birth. You know, sometimes I think, you know, I won't pretend to, I won't be black and white on that and say that some people aren't born very sensitive. You've heard of an HSP, the highly sensitive person. Some people are just born more sensitive. Those people are more prone to anxiety, I think, than other people. And we're learning now through the science of epigenetics that sometimes when a parent becomes dysregulated due to a certain circumstance and then develops a fear, a phobia, and anxiety in a given area, their child ends up with it. And then that child will say, well, my mom had it, my grandma had it, we've all had the same anxiety, it's genetic. It's not so much genetic that you're stuck with it and you can't overcome. It's epigenetic or above the gene, meaning that tendency has been trained into the nervous system, but it doesn't mean, again, that you can't train it out. It's not a DNA. It's not passed on through the DNA like Down syndrome or, you know, one of these disorders.
Yeah, it's nurture versus nature.
Yeah, so there's both. I mean, and I'll say this. This is something that I've come to realize is very interesting. The higher the IQ, the more prone someone is to anxiety because they can process and think in ways that other people aren't even capable of.
Well, that's good news for us then.
Yeah. So I will sometimes tell clients, especially young children, like I'll get, if I get a 12-year-old.
No, but you know what, Tiffany, I actually believe you because I was never thinking about it around anxiety. I used to think about it around depression. Because there was someone I used to, this was a company I worked at years ago, and there was this person who was always very, very super positive, but not forced. They were naturally always a bit, it was just their way. You could tell they were not forcing it. It is just who they were. And but they were also not the brightest bulb in the sunbed, if you know what I mean. They just weren't, you know, not really on it. And one time we were all sat down, we were just all talking, and he said out loud, because I think someone was talking about, you know, feeling depressed or whatever. And then he said, oh, I have never been depressed. And I looked at and all of us kind of chuckled a little bit because we 100% believed him. And I was like, I actually believe you that you've never been depressed. He just did not have it. You could tell he just did not have it in him. To go like in those dark places, which is super good, right? Great for him. I'm not saying he would never be depressed, you know, I'm not saying like in the future, maybe something, you know, but I believe like he just never was really that super deep. And when he said he never got depressed, I was like, yeah, I can see that.
Oh, and because really highly intelligent people often think about like the mysteries of the universe, you know, they're pondering the mysteries of the universe at age 10, when the average 10-year-old is wondering, you know, if they're going to get that new basketball, you know, and I've seen that with kids. I had a client, this kid was so intelligent and he was doing poorly in school. He had to be pulled out for his anxiety. He was horrendously depressed and not functioning. And honestly, this kid just had no self-esteem and did not realize. I said to the dad, I go, this kid is a genius. And one of my jobs working with him was to convince him to see his own worth. And it turned out, you know, this kid was super intelligent and it had just gone unrecognized because he doesn't think like everyone else. And if you think about some of the, like Einstein, he didn't think like everyone else. Well, that was a good thing. Yes. Or we wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't have benefited from his brain. And we even have living examples today of people who are super smart, who've invented things or, you know, wrote books and things like that. You know, if you look at their lives, it's pretty interesting because you will see the struggles that they've had with depression and anxiety. I think depression is more circumstantial. Then, like I get so many people and I'll say, you know, what are you coming to see me for? I'll say, I have depression and anxiety. And I always ask this question. If your anxiety were gone tomorrow, would you still be depressed? And 90% of them will say no. So they don't really have a separate problem. They're depressed because anxiety sucks. Okay. And then other people are depressed, that remaining percentage, they're depressed because there's some difficult stuff going on in their life that needs to be sorted. And maybe they don't have the confidence to sort it. But if, you know, if you're that kind of person, and this is a blessing for people that lives 100% in the present moment and never thinks past the next 10 minutes, probably not going to have the tendency to be anxious and depressed as much. But you also don't think deeply, as deeply. So there's a blessing in being highly intelligent and a deep thinker, and then there's a curse. But the good news is I don't want anyone listening to this podcast to think, oh, well, great, I'm stuck this way because I'm so smart. It's not that. Your brain can be trained. That's the beauty of our brains. The science has learned that they are neuroplastic. They can be programmed, you know, trained. The word manipulation doesn't set right with me, but you can learn to change your thinking. You can learn to change even your physiological reactions, all of that. And it's a blessing.
Yeah, of course.
And you can keep the intelligence. You can come out the other end being just as intelligent as you were and not have anxiety. Peace of mind is available to all of us.
Tiffany, thank you so much. Again, like, honestly, I barely said anything because I was just listening and absorbing as much as I could while you were talking. So absolute pleasure. I wanted to ask you the two finishing thoughts that I ask all of my guests, and it'd be interesting to see if these are different. I forgot to pull them up, actually. Sorry, I should have pulled up the answers that you said last time, and I didn't. But
that's okay. Maybe they've changed.
they usually change when I've managed to remember to pull them up. But yeah, sorry, I didn't this time. But what life? So the first one is, what life lesson do you wish you'd learned sooner?
Well, currently, I think that would be the lesson I've learned that so many of my physical problems that I've had over the years were actually my brain sending me a message because it didn't feel safe. And to listen to that, I just spent most of my adult life ignoring that and trying to repress it and push it away and powering through because I wanted to be successful. Instead of taking that time for self-care, self-reflection, and because those, when we listen to our bodies, when we listen to our minds, there's so much healing and growth that occurs that we are not getting if we're trying to power through and push it aside. And we power through and push it aside because we think we have to do that if we're going to be successful, if we're going to keep moving, if we're going to be strong. But you end up exponentially stronger and wiser and better by actually attuning to all that and listening to the messages of the mind and body.
Mm. And the second one is, what do you not put up with anymore?
Oh, I love this question. And I don't remember what I answered it last time, but disrespect. I do not tolerate disrespect. I confront it. If someone is disrespecting me, I used to be the professional doormat. So if I could recover from being a doormat, anyone can. I will say that because I would take any kind of crap from anybody. I'm not easily offended. I think it's important to make that point that we don't want to become the opposite and just be offended by everything anyone says. But if someone is disrespecting me, and I'll tell you what that looks like. Eye rolling, condescension, talking to me like I'm stupid. You know, in a conversation I'm having with that person, I have this simple phrase. I think this will be useful to listeners. I also teach to clients, and I will say to that person, you know, I was enjoying this conversation, but I do not believe in arguing, and I don't. I won't argue with people. Say so. If we can continue to have this conversation, you can treat me with respect. Good. But if you're going to disrespect me, and I might point out how they're doing that, this conversation's over. And when you're ready to respect me, we'll continue it. And if they demonstrate by their behavior, their words, that they cannot talk to me, speak to me, treat me with respect, I'm out. I will hang up the phone. I will get up and walk out of the room. I will get in my car and drive away. And if that behavior is going to be consistent, I remove the person from my life. And I don't think twice about it. I don't care if it's a family member, relative. The person is removed from my life, and they're not allowed back in until they respect me, you know. And I don't mean, you know, I don't need them to bow down to me. I just want to be talked to like a friend, okay? Yeah. I will not be screamed at. And if someone raises their voice, begins to scream at me, conversation's over until you get self-control. And that has saved me so much grief because my peace of mind at 55 years old is my number one priority, and I don't let anyone take that from me.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. No, that's really good. That's really good, Tiffany. Please tell us, where can we find you? How can people work with you? Give us all the good stuff.
Okay. So I have a website, Tiffany with an I, T-I-F-F-A-N-I, Capello. C-A-P-P-E-L-L-O, TiffanyCapello.com. If you want to learn more about transformational hypnosis and my panic proof protocol and coaching, things like that. I also have a YouTube channel. There's not a huge amount of videos on there. I'm working on it. My goal there is to provide as much information as I can for free to people. And that is A Transform Life with Tiffany Capello. I also have a podcast by the same name that's just kind of getting started. So it's in its infancy stage, but you can contact me there. I'd be happy to help anyone to overcome panic, anxiety, negative thinking, all that stuff.
Thank you so much, Tiffany. Thank you, thank you, thank you. It's been a real pleasure to have you back. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And that's our episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend. It can be a screenshot that you text them, a link, the name of it. Any of those will do. If you give a 5-star rating and a review, that really, really helps the algorithm for it to be shared on all the different platforms. And just a little note, please be aware that this podcast is always free to listen to. Any platforms that want to charge you for it are doing so without my consent, okay? This is free. You can listen to it on Apple, Spotify, all of the other regular listening platforms that don't charge you. This is free. So don't let someone charge you to listen to my podcast. Until next time.
Using health inappropriately.